for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Melody Fox, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Dr. Melody Fox, as Alan Cardoza is off on his family vacation this holiday and wishes you a happy holiday week, and he will be planning to return next week while I'll be off on vacation. And each week, one or both of us will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. We address many great ways to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually healthy. Now, combined, we have more than 50 years experience working with families in crisis and have been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. We will continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring to you Answers for the Family. Now, our topic today is unconditional love and discussing why are you waiting to live? Now, our guest today, Dr. Asa Don Brown's background includes working as a therapist, advocate, inspirational and motivational speaker, author, musician, and professor. Now, he holds a doctorate in philosophy with a specialization in clinical psychology from Capella University, a master's of science with a specialization of counseling with the emphasis on marriage and family from the University of Great Falls, and a bachelor's of science in theology and religion with a minor in marketing from the University of Great Falls. Now, Dr. Brown is also an author for the Canadian Counseling and Psychotherapy Association and a faculty member at Royal Roads University in Victoria, British Columbia. Now, Dr. Brown is currently involved in authoring two more books anticipated to be published in the new year, with his latest book titled Waiting to Live, which is available now. So, Dr. Brown, welcome to Answers for the Family. And I hope we didn't lose our connection here, Dr. Brown.
Hi.
There you are.
I don't know if you heard me. I'm appreciative of the opportunity to join you and your audience. Sorry about that.
No problem. I guess we had to unmute you, huh?
Yes, we did.
Well, welcome to our edition of Answers for the Family. Now, your book, Waiting to Live, I mean, today we're interested in your book because it appears to be a mixture of your own exploration of psychology intermingled with your own spiritual quest for life. And you have a lot of background. You know, you study theology, religion, you know, and psychology, and, you know, marketing's a great thing. I wish more people were doing that. But yeah. Anyway, welcome. What do you want to tell us? I mean, how did you come to the idea of developing your book in the first place?
Well, you know, I wrote this book to provide an opportunity for individuals in my counseling office, as well as my own friends and family, you know, that are struggling with psychological and spiritual stressors, to find, you know, some sort of reprieve from these challenging thoughts that, you know, often plague you and I and plague others. And also to, you know, just offer a tool that will help them to live life productively and in a positive way.
Right. And to live life productively, that's what most of the time when they come into our practice, they want to learn how to live a more productive life, how to be happier, and how to live their life.
Exactly.
So, go ahead.
No, you know, and I find that a lot of it, too, is, I mean, there's a lot of great self-help books out there today, but it's just knowing what one's going to match me as an individual, finding that book that's going to speak to me. And, you know, I realize my book will speak to some and may not speak to all, but I can tell you that, you know, through my practice, I've used a lot of these tools that I've written in my book, that I've placed into the book, in my practice, and I have found several of them to be effective. And as you know, Dr. Fox, some things work with one patient and they don't work with the next patient. And so I tried to intermingle a number of approaches into this book so that hopefully we'll make a match somewhere throughout the book.
Well, it seems like, you know, you're really talking about unconditional love in your book. How does that play a role in waiting to live or learning to live?
Well, you know, one thing I have seen, I mean, my background was ministry, and I left ministry several years ago to do a degree in counseling and also in psychology. It's not any different. I still consider this a form of ministry, you know, helping people to not, you know, in some cases, you know, we have major psychological disorders that, yes, you know, medications need to help treat them, and certain therapeutic styles will help them, orientations will help them. But in a number of my cases, in my office, in my practice, I find that individuals come to me just needing to know how to forgive themselves, needing to know how to love themselves, and needing to know how to love others.
Well, how do you do that?
Well, how do you do that? That's a great question. Well, you know, one thing I have discovered through my own personal life, you know, is in order to love yourself unconditionally, you have to let go of the conditions we place on life. You have to let go of those things that have defined you. You know, you think of a police officer, and a police officer retires. He's still a police officer. He sees himself as a police officer. Now, if you have a police officer that is injured and he's no longer able to be a police officer, he still feels like a police officer, but he cannot see himself as a police officer anymore, often because he's unable to fill that role. And in my book, one thing I tried to get to the heart of is when we love ourselves unconditionally, we don't see ourselves as our successes or our failures. Rather, we see ourselves as a spiritual being, that internal being that guides us to do what's right and what's wrong, but not seeing ourselves. You know, if I have to see myself as my failures, I'm looking in the past always, and I'm thinking of myself in a negative, you know, perspective. Mm-hmm. And yet if I see myself as the things I've accomplished in life, if I see myself as someone that's accomplished a doctorate and one day I can no longer use that doctorate, what's going to happen to me?
Mm-hmm.
How will I begin to see myself? And so I realized that, you know, we have to look at ourselves and know that we should have no conditions in our life.
Mm-hmm.
We should take those conditions off of ourselves. You know, the condition of being a good person, a bad person, failure or success, and start seeing ourselves as someone that's just genuinely human, genuinely wanting to love, wanting to live life in a productive way, in a positive way.
So it's instead of looking outside to the things that we accomplished or the things that we failed, look at our sum total of who we are in this moment, which all
That's
our
exactly
failures or challenges, I like to call them, and our successes all make us who we are today.
Yes, yes. Well, and I you say that about challenges. It's what I often speak of to my patients. You know, if it's a challenge, I think of it as a barrier. I think of it as sort of a roadblock. Just because there's a barrier or roadblock doesn't mean I can't go around it.
Right. Or go through
doesn't
it.
Doesn't mean I can't leap over that, right?
Mm-hmm.
I choose to allow the barrier to block me.
And then you get stuck.
And then we get stuck. And we become kind of emotional of whatever has occurred in our life. We continue to think on those things that have caused us harm or perhaps have been good in our lives, too. I've had patients in the past that have come into my office and said, you know, I wish I could just win one more time a game, or I wish I could just be what I was.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, but you're greater than what you were. What you were was just a historical marker in your life. And it doesn't have to define you. You don't have to be defined by that success. And for those that often come into my office saying, listen, I can't get over the fact that I've done this wrong or I've done that wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I, you know, I often think on my children. And if I love my child, I love my children, I need to look at my children and realize that if I hold something over them, I'm defining them by whatever it is I'm holding over them. And if I can't forgive myself, I'm teaching my child not to forgive themselves. I may look at my child and say, I love you, no matter what, without any conditions. You can do right, you can do wrong, you can do great things, you can do wrong things.
Mm-hmm.
But if I tell my child that, you know, I can only love you as long as you meet these certain expectations, then I'm placing conditions on the love of my child.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, you're talking, and I'm thinking about roadblocks, and I know in my practice I get a lot of people in that are stressed out by their work, and they feel like if they don't do this job, they're nobody. So they have to keep pushing themselves, even though they're maybe that's not the healthiest job for them to be in. So trying to get them to accept who they are as a person and who they are as an entity or a spiritual self or whomever, instead of they are not that job title, because that's outside themselves instead of inside themselves. You know, that that's a hard roadblock for some people to get past, because they always knew their parents were this, so they had to grow up to be that, and that's that expectation.
And especially for individuals that come from generations of being military or pastors or firemen or whatever the profession is, you know, they see themselves as not only this, but as obligated to that profession as well. You know, that my father did this, so I've got to do this, and I've got to maintain. And what happens if I can't maintain? Or if, or on the other hand, if someone has seen us as, you know, take a pastor, for instance, as their pastor for years, and one day they stop being a pastor, you know, they'll still consider themselves, having been in ministry myself, I still see myself at times as someone that's in ministry. You know, I still recognize those pastoral traits. But I also recognize that that has only been a tool to help me in other aspects of my life. It's helped me to move forward and do greater things, you know, and it's, it doesn't have to define that. I don't have to be that pastor, but I can be Asa Brown with a tool that was a pastor.
And thinking about that, of taking those different aspects of your life, and that's all part of who you are, how do you get past that roadblock when you feel like who you are isn't enough and you are waiting to live?
Well, you know, and it's part of seeing ourselves differently, right? You know, one thing I use with my patients is what I call a mirror assignment. And I have my, I have them go home, and I, and we write out, before going home, of course, we write out some, just some positive affirmations. You know, I love myself. I like myself. I like others. I love others. But most of all, it's the person inside that I'm in love with. And no matter what I do right, no matter what I do wrong, I'm going to love that person. And I'll have them often take that home and look in the mirror and try to say that to themselves. It's got to be one of the most challenging things I offer my patients. And I tell them, you know, if you can't do this, don't try doing it until you're at that moment that's right. Because we don't want to cause harm either, you know. And, you know, and we don't want to push patients before they're ready to be pushed, right, in those areas. And, you know, being able to get to that place of saying, you know, I love myself, I can accept myself, I appreciate myself. You know, we have to be able to let down our guard. We have to be able to do away with what we know as, that we've defined ourselves as, you know, setting aside that cloak and looking at ourselves anew, you know, and that is challenging. And, you know, there's not, you know, there's not a magic pill. I wish there was.
Oh, me too.
And there's, what's that? You know, and there's not one answer to that, you know, and one reason I wrote this book was to offer to my patients to say, listen, this is only a stepping stone. This is the beginning. And part of that is I believe for all of us, we have to continuously work on ourselves as individuals, because honestly, you know, if you sit back and ate ice cream all day long for days on end, what's going to happen to our physical condition is we're going to probably gain a pound or two. Now, ice cream likes me, and I tend to gain more than a pound or two. So anyhow, the point is, you know, we have to sit back and recognize that it's going to take, just like an athlete, we're going to have to work at it daily. And we're going to have to work at our thoughts. And we're going to have to know what thoughts we're entertaining. Are we entertaining positive thoughts, or are we entertaining negative thoughts?
Right. And a lot of what I read about the book and about you and what you're saying here, it's almost a cognitive approach.
It is.
Retraining your thoughts. And,
yeah.
And to go back to that mirror assignment, those positive affirmations in the mirror, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you could tell your clients or your children or your family or give them positive affirmations to do in the mirror, but it's really difficult to look at yourself in the mirror and say those things and believe it sometimes. And because it's so ingrained that you aren't lovable, or you are always going to be a nurse, or you're always going to be a doctor, or you're always going to be whatever the family thing is. It's hard to go past that sometimes and really start to believe and integrate it. But how, I mean, I know how important it is, but can you explain how important it is to start retraining your thoughts and your mind to start thinking a different way?
Well, you know, it's vitally important. You know, if we don't look at retraining the way we think and working on those things, you know, it's a part of its personal responsibility. You know, I talk about personal responsibility in my book, and, you know, and if I, well, you know, take my daughter again, you know, my daughters. Sorry, I've got a 9-month-old daughter, by the way,
that's
and I've got a 7-year-old daughter, so it's still hard for me to wrap my head around. I've got 2 daughters, so anyhow, I'm sure you understand. But, you know, it's taking that personal responsibility.
Yeah.
And recognizing that whatever I do will affect others in my life.
Right.
You know, if I do something to myself, you know, I can tell my daughter on a daily basis, you know, I love you. You're beautiful. You're intelligent. You're capable. I can give her so many positive affirmations and strokes. But if Asa doesn't believe it, she'll pick up on that.
Mm-hmm.
And she'll begin believing that as well, that Delilah or Esperanza are my daughter's names, that they are not worthy, that they are not lovable, that they're not acceptable. And, you know, it's taking that responsibility and understanding that we have to have a willingness to completely accept the choices we've made throughout our lives, whether positive or negative. Mm-hmm. We don't have to be defined by them.
Right.
We just have to accept them as, hey, okay, I messed up, or, wow, I won. But that doesn't mean I have to stop there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we put a ceiling on ourselves and say, this is as much as I can do, or this is as much as I can achieve, then that's where we're at.
Right.
We'll not go beyond that. And so a lot of it is about taking ownership of what we have intentionally or unintentionally done right or wrong, those choices we've made in life. You know, Christopher Reeve is one guy I had great respect for. After, of course, I didn't know much about him before his accident. But, you know, in my book, I talk about him, and I talk about the fact that he looked at this and he said, okay, I have to make a choice here. Am I going to allow what has occurred in my life to be the end of my life? Or am I going to push forth and strive for a better life? And, you know, I think he takes that in all aspects of our life and apply that. And think about, what can I do to live a more productive life? What can I do to live a more positive life? And a lot of that is by saying, I'm going to take the responsibility. I'm not going to have blame or shame in my life. I'm not going to look at myself and condemn myself for the things I've done wrong or right. You know, instead, you know, is looking past the things we've done in our lives. Do not, you know, I talk about, do not allow your past to control your reality, you know, but rather allowing the unconditional love that we have for ourselves, that we should learn to gain in our lives, and allowing those things to be overcome
mm-hmm.
through the love that we have for ourselves. You know, if I say I love my daughter unconditionally, and she comes to me and says, Daddy, I've done this wrong, and I place a condition on her because of what she's done wrong, then I don't love my daughter unconditionally, do I?
Mm. That's an interesting point.
And, you know, I find that we talk about this unconditional love, and we talk about it in all circles of life. I mean, whether theologically or psychologically,
mm-hmm.
we talk about unconditional love. You know, Carl Rogers, I love Carl Rogers, and he talked about that unconditional positive regard.
Right.
What does that mean, to have unconditional positive regard? Well, to me, it means that I look at myself as Asa Brown, and yes, I've got all these different cloaks, and I've got all these different armors that I've tried putting on myself, but who I really am goes deeper. You know, I don't know if you've run across this or not, but I often have atheists come into my office. I often have people of various faiths come into my office.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, I love it because I learn a lot. And they'll look at me and say, well, you know, I don't buy into the spiritual aspect of your book. And I say, okay, fine, let's set that aside. Let's set aside the spirituality. And let's think on this. Have you, and I know I have, I've had people come to me often and say, well, you don't really know someone. You know, they'll be talking about this person, and I'll say something, and they'll say, you don't really know that person. If you really knew that person, you would know this about them.
Hmm.
And what I think we're talking about here, if you're setting spirituality aside, is knowing the real person, knowing that inner part that few people get to really know, what makes us tick,
right?
What causes us to think the way we think.
And knowing the real person, too, sometimes people come in the office and they do have a lot of shame or self-blame, and they don't want to show you their real selves because they're so they've got so much fear about doing that. And and that's helping them learn that it is a safe place and that they don't have to blame themselves or shame themselves or be dependent upon what other people think of them, be more resilient on providing that love for themselves and acceptance of themselves. Can you talk about people's reliance upon others for their self-esteem or personal security?
Oh, I can. Yes, and, you know, it's something, too, you know, and I don't know if you've learned from your educational background, but I can tell you I've learned a lot. Mm-hmm. And I love having patients, by the way, because I love having people in my life because I'm always, it's like a well for me. I'm always learning from them. And so from my experiences, one thing that I have found is, you know, you take this example. You have someone that walks outside. And now, I don't know where you live in California, but where I'm at, we get a lot of snow. Mm-hmm. And a lot of snow and a lot of ice. And if you take an individual and they get out of the car, and they slip and fall. What's the first thing that we do when we slip and fall? We're trained to look around, to see who's looking at us, to see what they're thinking, see what we may be thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And we have shame about that. Embarrassment, fear is what that boils down to.
Right.
And in my life, I look at that and say, why? Why should I have embarrassment or fear because of an accident, a mishap, rather to look beyond that and begin recognizing that I don't need someone else's approval. Now, don't take me wrong. I've had people say, well, that sounds almost narcissistic. It's not narcissism. And in my opinion, and you may disagree with me, but I think narcissism is not much different from dependent personality. They're very similar. A narcissist hides behind a wall and says, I don't need you. And behind that wall says, I really need you.
Right.
And, you know, but someone that's healthy, and I think a narcissist tries to masquerade as someone that's healthy, someone that's independent, someone that doesn't need someone else.
Well, they're trying to convince.
When we love what's that?
They seem to try to convince everybody that they don't need
them. They are. And when someone loves themselves, they genuinely, unconditionally love themselves, what they're doing is they're accepting themselves. They're approving of themselves. And that's one thing I find for a lot of people is we're looking for approval and acceptance from others. We're looking to be, and again, that's a form of a condition. And we're fearful not to have that.
Mm-hmm.
And what if I get disapproved of by whomever?
Right.
Oh, no, I don't want to disappoint them. And it comes down to approving and accepting who we are, not based on other things, but based solely on who we are, not based on our history, but based on our spirituality.
So in basing all that on our spirituality and accepting who we are and loving ourselves, and is that the definition of happiness?
I would say that the definition of happiness for me is peace. A peace that says no matter what happens in life, no matter where I am, I can be at peace with myself. I can love myself no matter what occurs in life. I'm a visual person, and one thing, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Life is Beautiful, but there was a scene in that movie where it talks to Robert Benigni, I believe is who is the actor, and Robert Benigni has a son, and I believe they were in Italy, and they were taken, and they were put into this concentration camp. And in that concentration camp, he tried to make everything looked good for his son. It was just an adventure for his son.
I do recall the movie now, yes.
Yeah, and, you know, real peace comes no matter where I'm at. I'm going to have peace. You know, life is beautiful in spite of the environment I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I define that. Am I going to see this as a good thing or am I going to see this as a bad thing? And I didn't see this as a challenge. And, you know, I think often what happens is when we're being tried, we see it as something against us rather than an obstacle for us to overcome.
Right.
And that's how I like seeing life. You know, I had to learn to rewalk back in 1980. I've got plastic joints in both ankles.
Wow.
And the reason I mention that is I also talk a little bit about it in my book. And I'll tell you, that was an obstacle for me. That was a challenge. I was an 8-year-old child, turned 9 in hospital. And learning to rewalk was probably one of the greatest challenges that's ever overcome me in my life. You know, and doing that, I couldn't do that right away. It took time. It took effort. And I think often people burn out or give up rather than just being diligent and pursuing life, you know, and living a life. You know, life is beautiful. And so seeking that, you know, it is a bit about resiliency as well.
Mm-hmm. I was just curious, yeah. When you were 8 or 9 and going through all that, mm-hmm. did your faith play a part in that, or trusting that you were going to be able to walk again, or nothing was going to stop you from doing what you wanted to do, or how did that part come about?
Yeah, well, my faith did play a large part of that. You know, my faith, faith of others, my doctor. This was in Oklahoma City, and my physician was a Christian fellow. Now, whether you're a Christian or whatever faith you come from, I think that faith has been shown to be a positive force for transformation, for overcoming things, for helping in our resiliency. But also, I would say part of it was also my doctor's unwillingness to allow me to, you know, he took me into a room and set me there. And I recall this the first time, you know, this physician did this, and he set me down on the floor and said, I want you to try to get up. Now, it was so painful. I was in agony. He wasn't thinking I was going to walk. Rather, he was putting in me the mindset that I want you to try. I want you to attempt it, no matter what. I don't want you to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say that both my faith and my position in my life played an intricate role in why I have this desire to live life in spite of whatever comes my way, good or bad.
So why wait to live? Why let that obstacle get in your path and stop you from living your life to the best that it could be right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I find that, you know, in the first chapter of my book, I talk about waiting to live and how we wait for, you know, traffic signals, we wait for restaurant lines, we wait and we wait and we wait. But the reason we wait is the fear that says, I don't think I can do it. I don't think I can overcome it.
Huh.
It's too big of a challenge for me. And I think that's why we often, all of us, at one point or another, have played that waiting game.
So we put that negative thought or those negative blocks on ourselves.
Yes.
Okay. Well, we've got to take a quick break, Dr. Brown, but today our guest on Answers for the Family is Dr. Asa Dawn Brown, the author of the great book, Waiting to Live, and we're going to talk more to him, and we have some listener questions coming up in just a moment, so stand by.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back to more Answers of the Family. I'm your host today, Dr. Melody Fox. Alan Cardoza is on vacation for Thanksgiving week, and he's looking forward to joining us again next week. But today, I'm excited because I get to have Dr. Asa Don Brown all by myself with his new book called Waiting to Live. And I like the whole concept of it, Waiting to Live. And what I found interesting was there wasn't a question mark after the title. It's just Waiting to Live. So can you describe how you came up with that title?
Okay. Well, yes, I can. You know, I was thinking about what it was, the real essence of my book. What was I trying to get across to folks? And I began thinking on that, and I realized, you know, what is the one thing we're all striving for? And that is to live a life that's successful, that's happy, that's filled with joy, that's filled with peace. It was that waiting that got me. And I began recognizing, you know, I've heard individuals say this often, you know, I will do this when I can. I will try this when I can. I will try this when I retire. I will try this when I have enough money. And I heard that same theme throughout, not just working with those in my private practice, but working with those individuals in various spectrums of my life, students in university. You know, why didn't you try harder? Well, I was waiting until I really understood, you know, or I didn't get it, so I just put it off. So in essence, they were waiting. I put it off. I'll try it another day. And so that waiting, the thing that we all, I think, rely on, is a way for us to put off what we can do today until tomorrow, till we feel more peace about it, till we feel more confidence in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so I think on the salmon, for instance, and, you know, and how they migrate. And salmon are, you know, something that we often don't think about as far as a metamorphosis type experience. But, you know, they go into the ocean, they leave the rivers, mm-hmm. and they go into the ocean, and they swim about, and they come back to spawn. And as they're coming through that river, you know, could you imagine if they decided to think, you know, hey, listen, I don't want to try that. I'm not going to go up that river. That's too much work. And I don't know if you know this or not, but on their voyage up, they do spawn, and they do lay their eggs. Mm-hmm. That's their last voyage of life.
Right.
And so for some, I think it's, what if I fail? I'll just wait.
But
I don't want to
move.
Go up that river.
Then you're stuck.
Then we're stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, then we're stuck. And, you know, the thing is why I didn't make it a question, why aren't you waiting to live, is because I believe that a lot of people are waiting to live. They're waiting to live until that day that they feel confident enough to voyage up that river.
Mm-hmm. And so in reading your book, how are you going to guide them through that?
Well, you know, I struggled with that. And one thing I have tried doing is offering a number of different challenges. Now, again, instead of using the word assignment, or homework. I've had so
like
many ones that come in. What was that?
I don't like the word homework.
Yeah. No, and I've had so many, exactly. You know, I've had so many come in and say, I don't want to do any homework, you know, or I don't want to do any assignments. And I had to think about that for a long time, and I thought, why don't we just call them challenges?
Right.
I like a good challenge. And so I called them chapter challenges at the end of each chapter. I've offered various type challenges, from journaling to meditating to breathing exercises to redesigning our core beliefs, strengthening those core beliefs and transforming those through this meditation, as well as how we think, how we see ourselves. I think that's a large problem for people, is that they see themselves as, you know, I don't know if this has ever happened to you. It has happened to me. I went back for my 20th high school reunion last year. And when I got home, I recall almost feeling like I had failed in high school. And I asked myself, why am I feeling certain emotions that I felt like when I was in high school? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I began thinking on that. And I think for a lot of people, we get stigmatized, or we get labeled, or we get categorized as a certain individual. Mm-hmm. And we take on that role when we're around others that we might revere or fear. And so what I try doing is helping them to develop themselves spiritually, physically, and mentally. Now, I also look at our human body as three parts. I look at the brain, and I consider it kind of a motor. I consider it an engine. Now, you could put all kinds of information in it. It will not do anything until you gear it, put into gear, and try to operate it. That brain is just going to take in information, and it's going to put out information. But it doesn't typically come up with its own information. Our spirit is yet a second part of that being. And it's the part that I think is kind of our Jiminy the Cricket. It's the positive approach. It's looking at us going, okay, you can do this. You can. You know, you can make it up the hill. And then we've got our body, our physical body. And I don't know if you've ever had this, but my brain, my physical brain, reminds me of a lot of things I've done right and things I've done wrong. And I have to retrain that brain to start seeing myself as the person that I am internally. And taking those three and understanding that, you know, it is amazing that our brain can recall things from years ago. Mm-hmm. And we have to take that and understand that, listen, whatever has happened in my life, that's just a part of my past. And so, to answer your question, I have a number of different assignments or tasks or challenges, as I like to call them, that help individuals move beyond that conditional state, trying to conquer the fear that often returns to us when we are trying to live an unconditional life. Mm-hmm. You know, I think without fear and conditions, we could live an unconditional life and live a very happy life.
Oh, yes. That but fear just gets in the way of everything, doesn't it?
They do. Yes, they do.
But adding the unconditional love, and I think everybody's capable of loving yourself, but it's learning how to do that unconditionally is key.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, and I, again, you know, I think it's something we have to strive towards. You know, I've never had a person come into my office and love themselves unconditionally instantly. You know, some that come into my office began, and I'm going to say this, we're not going to perfect it either.
Oh, it's a good challenge.
No, none of us are going to come to a point and say, I love myself unconditionally, no matter what.
Well, if you like a good challenge, that's something to go after every single day and every single moment.
Yes, and you know, and it's something we have to keep our mind on. You know, it's something we have to think about constantly. You know, and you know, we think on all kinds of things. I love it when I have someone come in and say, you know, I'm stuck. I've got this tape playing in my mind, and I keep playing the same thought over and over and over. And it's something mom said, or that dad said, or that my brother said, or whomever. Or perhaps I created for myself. Mm-hmm. And I just keep playing this thought. And so what I try to do is, instead of fighting it, I mean, if you fight the thought, it's going to get worse. It's going to stay there. You know, I don't want to think this. Oh, darn it, I'm thinking it.
Because
rather,
you're thinking about not thinking it.
Yes, let's not even challenge that thought. Uh-huh. Let's challenge the thought by doing this, by thinking a new thought.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's what I have them do often. And, you know, and again, in the book, I offer journaling exercises. I offer I statements. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with I statements.
Absolutely.
You know. Yeah, and, you know, and I offer images as well in there. You know, and I try to hit different ways of thinking, different perspectives of learning as well. Because, you know, the one that I like personally is I like to play hide-and-go-seek. Now, I'm 40 years old, and I still like to play hide-and-go-seek.
Well, you've got
I don't
some
know.
Kids to play with, too.
You know, and so a part of that is, you know, I tell them, you know, let's go and play a game of hide-and-go-seek. Play peekaboo. Do what some of you don't even know. play peekaboo with someone in the mall. You know, it, of course, I've had very few take me up on this. But but the thing is, you know, be willing to get outside ourselves. You know, children are so resilient. Mm-hmm. And we, as a society, make them less resilient. Well, don't try that. That's dangerous. Be careful.
Don't embarrass me.
What's that?
Don't embarrass me or your father.
Yeah, don't embarrass me. Yeah. Oh, no. I can't believe you did that. And the thing is I think a part of us, we need to become more childlike. I mean, if a child falls and skins his knee and he's playing on a playground, unless mom is looking or dad's looking, he's more apt to just get up, dust himself off, mm-hmm. and play.
Oh, yeah. They generally fall, then they look around to see what they're supposed to do.
Yes, yes. And so I think that's what we've got to strive for, is becoming childlike.
Allowing that child part come out and play.
Yeah. You know, one thing that comes to mind is my child. Mm-hmm. When I have done something that, oh, I'm sorry, baby, I didn't mean to say that or do that. You know, and I'm not a perfect parent. I'm sorry to announce that. I try my best. But, she forgives me. And she lets it go. And I find, wow, that's the way we should be.
And do you find that you tend to hold on to it?
Do I tend to hold on to it? Okay. You know, I would say I probably, yes, longer than my child would.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And that's something to be learned from our children, too. And that's part of loving someone unconditionally. You know, she loves her papa. She loves her daddy.
Yeah.
And,
okay,
so now can we go play hide and seek again?
Yes, yes. Well, and, you know, and it's that, you know, like the assignment in the mall, you know, playing peekaboo.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's getting over that embarrassment, too. You know, looking beyond our fears. You know, oh, what are people going to say if I play peekaboo?
Oh, yeah.
What will they say? I mean, what does it matter what they say, you know? You're living, and you're enjoying life. And, you know, to me, I mean, you know, I don't want to stop living on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Because what if I don't wake tomorrow?
I have chosen
not to live today.
And you're waiting, like you said, waiting for retirement, waiting for something else, waiting for somebody to do this, waiting for your big break, waiting for whatever before you actually go out and smell the roses and play peekaboo.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know,
what I think? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I have a couple listener questions I want to make sure I get to before our time's up. Can I jump in right here with a couple?
Go ahead.
Okay,
go ahead.
Great. We have a couple. And one says, one of the most important elements I've incorporated into my life in the recent years is living in the moment. I noticed that your book uses one of these as one of the fundamental cornerstones of living a fulfilling life. I've been trying to get my teenage son to understand the principle with little success. Is your book appropriate for a 17-year-old, and are there stories there that he could relate to?
I think so. I think that, you know, it depends on the child, of course. It depends on the individual.
Right.
I mean, some people, I've got patients that will tell me, would you put that on audio? Okay, we'll look at that. You know, if they're a reader, if they enjoy reading, I think it's applicable. And you know, the chapters, one thing I tried doing, this is my second attempt. My first one's my dissertation, and so we won't go there. But this is my second attempt to write a book, you know. And the dissertation I love, but, you know, it's research. I'm not a research guy, so anyhow, I don't enjoy reading it, I should say. But anyhow, you know, what I'm going to say is it would be something that, because it's short chapters, mm-hmm. they're pretty easy assignments. They're things that anyone can do, you know, that it would be applicable for a child that's 17 years old, you know, and now it would be challenging. And I think it'd be challenging for anyone,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that's one thing, you know, to take into consideration, but a challenge isn't a bad thing.
Oh, no, no, no. And I was thinking too, a 17-year-old, or it's like anybody of any age, if they're interested and they're willing, they'll read it. And if they aren't, they might not read it today, but they might in 5 years from now.
Yeah. And they might not tell you they read it.
That's true. We're talking teenagers there.
Okay.
And
I'm not reading that.
I have another listener question for you. It says, growing up in a strong Catholic family, it was impressed upon us that we should just live in faith, questioning nothing and believing everything the church teaches. Now at 43, I still love my church, but follow my gut, or what I call my consciousness. This is a theme that I hear from more and more of my family and friends. Do you feel that we're all evolving together?
I hope so. I really hope so, because, you know, I think that a lot of churches, yeah, I mean, they're well-meaning, you know, for the most part. But I think that the fact that so many churches have rigid ways, you know, and conditions on people, you shouldn't do that. You can't love yourself more than another. Now, I'll take a verse out of the Bible. And one thing that it came out to me when I was writing this, I never really saw this, and that is, in the Bible it says, love thy neighbor as you love thyself. Mm-hmm. Love thy enemy as you love thyself. Wow! Love thy enemy as you love thyself. If I can't love myself, how am I going to love my enemy?
Exactly.
And if I can't love myself, how am I going to love my neighbor or my child? And so, to answer your question, I do believe we're evolving, you know. Are we more intelligent than the last generation? Perhaps not. Are we spiritually on a perhaps better journey, a clearer journey? I hope so. But I think that's a part of life. We should always be striving to evolve.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah. I think it all is a journey. This whole life is a journey. And those that listen to Answers for the Family know that we're constantly trying to give information so people can continue to grow and continue to learn and look at things a different way so they could create the families that they want, to provide the environment for their children to strive and live and continue to grow and learn. And I like the whole idea of your book, and I really like how you've brought together that underlying spirituality and growth in there, as well as the psychological aspects of it. But I think the biggest thing is not allowing the state of others to influence how you are doing.
Yes. Well, and I think a part of it, too, is, you know, one of my chapters is on being offended. You know, and I've learned in my life, I've chosen to be offended. And often when I choose to be offended, the person that offended me may not even know it. And yet, boy, I keep that. And I will keep that forever, you know. And I think a part of that is and like many conditions we place in our life, we have to let those conditions go. We have to look at life and realize that, you know, if I'm offended, I'm choosing that. Why am I choosing to be offended? If someone does me wrong, they've done me wrong. It doesn't mean it has to be mine.
Right.
I can forgive them. I talk about forgiveness and you know, and acceptance of others. And I think that's an important part, is we have to learn to forgive others. Not so much that we, you know, it's like this. I use this example a lot with patients. You know, unconditionally loving my fellow human doesn't mean I have to trust my fellow human.
Mm-hmm.
And if I go into a supermarket with my infant, I wouldn't just hand my infant over to just anyone. You know, you don't know. And know that individual, but it doesn't mean that I wouldn't love them. If there was a tragic situation, it doesn't mean I wouldn't help them in that situation. But I don't have to trust my fellow human in the sense that, you know, that I have this unconditional acceptance that they won't do me harm. I'm not looking at others as though they'll harm me.
Mm-hmm.
And I shouldn't look at others as though I might harm them, but rather I'm going to love them. And through that love, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt as well.
And in loving them, you're learning to love yourself.
That's exactly right.
That unconditional love. And Dr. Asa Don Brown, I am so thankful that you're with us today. Our time has run out, unfortunately.
Oh.
But real quickly, where can people find your book?
My book is available online through most of the mainstream bookstores, Barnes & Nobles and Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so.
Okay. Well, the book is called Waiting to Live. Our guest today, Dr. Asa Don Brown. Again, you have a website, too, that people could go to?
Yes, it's asadonbrown.com.
Oh, that's
and
hard.
I'm yes. It's straightforward. And I also write for the Canadian Counseling and Psychotherapy Association.
Oh.
And they can find me on there as well.
And also, I do want to say that his website is great, and you have a blog. I don't know where you find the time to write all the articles or the blogs that you do, but it seems like you do two or three blogs a month, and they continuously grow, and you add to it, and it's just wonderful, a great resource as well. So thank you so much, and thank you again for joining us on Answers for the Family. I'm Dr. Melody Fox. Next week, Alan Cardozo will be back in the studio, and then we'll both be together in a couple weeks. Wish you well. A happy holiday season, and we will be talking to you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
She says, we're joining a health club. Did you hear what I said? I think I heard you say, you're fat, we're joining a health club. Not joining a health club. We're lazy people.